Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show. I'm your host, Stone Payton, joined by Lee Cantor. How are you, Lee?
I am doing awesome. So back in the United States of America, how's it feel?
Only because I'm out of money. Boy, did I have a great time last week in London.
You're going to move to Europe?
Well, I might, part of the year anyway.
Oh, part of the year?
Especially if I can do it on IBM's nickel. You know,
that's the key. It has to be subsidized.
And it was, and we had a ball. I don't think I missed a single pub in the entire London city limits.
So your wife was working, and you were gallivanting?
Yes, she was. And I got a chance to meet some really interesting, some of IBM's best and brightest in their human capital management practice. So I really did.
So it's not human resources anymore?
Well,
it's
not
human,
this group.
Human capital.
Yes, new buzzword.
Is that a promotion?
I don't know.
Demotion?
We'll ask our guest about it here in a little bit. But no, really, these people have such a tremendous handle on things like talent management and innovation and some of the things that I'm into, you know, in my day job.
Exactly. So you learned some stuff accidentally?
I did, over some dim sum in a restaurant called Ping Pong.
Ping Pong?
It was a blast. But we saw the Tower of London. I did a lot of this.
Your
on
wife
my
didn't see anything.
No,
she was in a conference room somewhere.
Right. I saw Tower of London, where they had the Beefeaters tell the story about all the executions. I saw Windsor Castle, and that was fine. That was marvelous, a lot of pageantry, a lot of opulence, and that was a lot of fun. But across the river from the Windsor Castle is a little town called Eton. And people that are, you know, a little more in the know than me may recognize the town because there's apparently a pretty famous college there, university.
Yes.
There. But there's also a couple of marvelous pubs there. And the beer's a little bit less expensive across the river, and I must...
So it's less touristy?
Yes.
It's a college town.
It's a college town, so you got to make the beer affordable, right?
Exactly.
So that was my logic. So I went across the river, and I had a pint or two or maybe three or four with some of the locals, and that was probably the highlight of the trip. So the only reason I'm back is because, you know, IBM would only fund it for so long.
Yes.
So here we are.
Is this going to be an annual event? Or
at least. It is for me. I don't know. Just depends on how much I can get funded. So how did it go last week without me?
It was a lot of fun. Don did a great job. Great job. Did you listen to it?
I didn't listen to it live.
I said you were listening live.
I know. I went back and heard
it. Put a little more pressure on Don.
Yeah, well, that's just what he needed. Was just a little more. But no, he's so conscientious, and the interviews were great. And now, I had not had an opportunity to meet the Coens, the Action Coach people that interviewed. So I haven't met them yet. I thought they did a marvelous job. Now, Brent Brooks, I have met before, and I am a little bit familiar with this ImprovaStorm process that he was describing.
Yes.
I've actually seen that in action.
You were on the hot seat.
A friend of mine, colleague of mine, and candidly an uncle of mine. He was on the hot seat, and it was fun to watch him articulate for them in the first few minutes of this session kind of what the business was about, what they were trying to accomplish. And then I heard Brent use the analogy in that interview of imagine a Saturday Night Live troupe acting out some of these things. That is exactly what it was like, and I had so much fun watching. And I cannot recommend strongly enough for an ad agency or an internal marketing department, if you're starting to get serious about particularly going viral with any kind of message, but in any messaging, there's just no reason not to book a Wednesday night or whatever night it is they do this and go out there and let these professional improv actors take a crack at interpreting what you're saying.
Right.
It was a blast.
You know, he had mentioned on that interview that he had just released a viral video for I think it's a plastic surgeon that does hair removal.
Right.
And it has now, in that week that's gone by, thousands of downloads. And
wow.
It has catapulted that guy. If you type in, like, Harry Back, his video shows up, like, front page of Google now.
Harry Back.
Something like that. So that's the power of that, of using that medium. That viral video is, it really can be a game changer. Because that person's video, if you look up that up, it doesn't say his company name until you click to see the video. But then his company name and phone number and stuff, website's all over the video. So it's a great way to get your name out there if you can pull it off. It's not easy.
I would certainly think so. But I think part of the challenge is, though, how do you create something that people are going to want to send on to the next guy, right, the next guy, the next guy? And to watch this troop take what I thought were business issues,
right,
and have the client the just fresh eyes, you know, on the floor.
Exactly. And then they're looking at it in such a fresh way.
Yeah. So it was a lot of fun. And so for whatever it's worth, those of you listening out there, you really ought to look into to what Brent Brooks and Blank Stage Productions are doing. So who's our sponsor this week?
This week, we are sponsored by Being First, a highly specialized change leadership development and transformational change consulting, training, and publishing firm. Being First serves executives in Fortune 1000 companies, government agencies, and large nonprofits, helping them design, people, and process solutions that ensure extraordinary results from change. That's www.beingfirst.com, 970-385-5100.
That was a mouthful.
And that was just off the top of my head.
Yeah, yeah. Who's writing your sponsor spots? Of course, I'm jesting, of course. I know very well who our sponsor is. This is an organization that I've had the opportunity to work very closely with over the last 4 or 5 years. And in fact, up until very recently, I was formally engaged with them as the closest thing that they had to a salesperson.
Oh.
And they, you know, they just got to where they were working too hard for my liking. So I went and found another day job.
Yeah.
But it's a marvelous outfit. And I knew that today part of our theme would be transformation, as we'll see here in a few moments when I introduce our guest today. But the other reason that I wanted to spotlight Being First, they now have a product's not fair. I guess I'd call it a process or a resource, but they have something called the Change Leaders Roadmap methodology,
mm-hmm,
and it is so deep and wide, so robust, a collection of very well organized resources for, I don't know a better way to say it, getting the real work of transformational change done. And they've made it available to individual practitioners. They've gotten the price point down on it where you don't necessarily have to license it as an organization. An individual practitioner or a small team out there can, for a very modest financial investment, license access to this methodology. And so I wanted to make people aware of that.
And it's really good methodology.
It's solid. It's structured, and it helps you do the things that you've got to do to achieve alignment in among the senior executive staff. It helps you plan. See, the challenge with transformation, I'm really anxious to talk to our guest today because I want to get his perspective as well. But in my experience, one of the great challenges with transformation is you're looking at a moving target.
Right.
You don't really necessarily have everything planned out and can't always define exactly where you're going to land in concrete terms. You've got to have a methodology, a repeatable set of processes that you can adjust so that you can make those mid-course
corrections. So it evolves as you go.
It does evolve. It lends itself to that, and it provides that that kind of feedback loop so that you can make those mid-course corrections. And it really is so.
And those corrections are inevitable, right?
Yeah, or you fail.
Right. So you got to be able to adjust.
Yeah, and we're talking about in this economy, but really in any economy, you know, the capacity, an organization's capacity to plan and execute change, It's no longer a luxury.
It means reality. Survival. Right.
Absolutely. So that's why they're the sponsor, and that's who they are, and I really do know them extremely well.
BeingFirst.com.
Yeah. And that really is the theme for today's show, is transformation, or more specifically today, transformational leadership. The gentleman that we have with us this morning is a guy by the name of Gregory P. Smith. Actually goes by Greg. I learned a little earlier. With Charter Course International. He is a widely recognized expert on transformational leadership. He's been featured in Business Week, USA Today, Human Resource Executive, and Bloomberg Television. He's now finally hit the big time and made it here on the High Velocity Radio Show. He's a best-selling author of no less than 9 books, and now he is the CEO of his own firm, Charter Course International. Welcome to the show, Greg Smith.
It's good to be here. I enjoy being able to talk about transformational leadership.
Well, what exactly is transformational leadership, and how does that differ, if at all, from what many of us would just call leadership?
Yeah, the way I look at it and why it's more important today than I think years previous is that there's, in my mind, two types of leaders, a transactional leader and a transformational leader. And when things are calm and when there are no threats on the horizons or no storms on the horizons, a transactional leader is perfectly acceptable for today's times. But today, because of all the changes happening in the global marketplace, we need leaders who can transform their organizations to relevance.
What does transactional mean? Like, how are you defining those terms?
Well, I'm not the first person to come up with those terms. People much smarter than me probably came up with these with many, many decades ago. But a transactional leader mainly focuses on individual processes, improving things. You know, Joel Barker, who's another expert in leadership, he talks about pioneers and settlers. Mm-hmm. A settler comes in, builds the buildings, builds the processes and the issues and making organizations work, while the pioneer is out there looking for new territory.
Right. They're gone to the next challenge.
And a recent incident happened with me last week. A young lady called me up from a large IT company, and she says, "Greg, you know, I found you on the internet, and I need to tell you what's happening in my workplace, and maybe you can help me." And she said, because the economy is changing, our company is cutting back. They said, we're now outsourcing more jobs to India, and there's this threat on us that if we don't improve productivity, that we could be the next one out the door. And, just a few weeks ago, we had an effective team. We worked together. We were innovative. We were creative. And now this fear, and that everybody's afraid to work with each other.
In a couple weeks?
Yeah. Well, I'm sure maybe it's a slight exaggeration. I'm sure that was a part of a gradual process. But, they were working together, and now the fact is this fear, intimidation, if you don't improve your productivity, no one now wants to work together because one person may look weak, one person may be strong, and then if you look weak, you're out the door. So what does that do to innovation and creativity? I mean, that's not transformational leadership.
Right. I see that a lot in especially big companies, where when you're in management of big companies, part of you're being told innovate, innovate, innovate. And then on the other hand, they're saying don't fail, don't fail, don't fail, because you're going to get dinged for failing. But can you innovate without risking anything and possibly failing horribly?
I think you have to accept the consequences many times. You remember a guy named Art Fry? He created the little yellow Post-it note.
Mm. Right.
And the interesting process, he worked for 3M, and I think the principle of the story is sometimes it takes a crisis to create innovation.
Right.
And his crisis was a small one. He was looking for a bookmark for his church hymnal. I think he was trying to keep a piece of paper. And when he was working with 3M, they had made this glue that was a failure. It didn't stick right.
Right.
And then somehow it fell on a piece of paper, and it stuck, and it was able to be removable. And, voila, there's the Post-it note. But interesting, it took years for the company to accept that idea. And you have to accept risk and failure if you're going to be innovative. Now, I had interesting experience. I worked for the U.S. Army Medical Department for many years, and I was the director of innovation. You're talking about a tough job. And I think when you lead into transformation, what is important is for an organization to change, it takes two things. And the larger the organization, the more true this is an organization will not change unless you either, number one, have a transformational leader or you hit a crisis. And many of these companies today have hit this crisis, which is, to me, this is a great opportunity to improve your business. Instead of, crying in your beer and say, woe is me, this is a terrible time, everybody's afraid of they're losing their job, and et cetera. This is a great place for transformational leaders to position their company ready.
For the future.
For the future.
Because we're not in a down market forever.
We hope not.
Well.
And we're all old enough. And, this isn't the first time this has happened. I wasn't alive during the Depression, which the political people always say, oh, this is the worst recession since the Depression. Well, I don't know if I accept that. You know, it's bad, but it's not the worst. This too will pass.
Well, why are businesses really in trouble today? Is it all external? Is it really all a factor of this thing called the economy outside the walls of my business? Or are there some things happening internally that just some mistakes and patterns of that you're seeing that they're just not doing some things real well?
Well, it's, the answer is yes and no. There's no one answer. Obviously, there are a lot of industries that have been devastated by this economy. I was talking to a guy last night. He was an independent plumber. And, you know, the housing industry.
It wasn't Joe, was it?
Interesting. I was in Toledo, Ohio the other week. I was speaking at this conference, and the bus driver from the airport says, hey, you know what we're famous for? This is the home of Joe the plumber. He
wow.
was very proud of it. I think he was the only Republican on the bus. But so there's a lot of factors into it. The guy I met last night, he lost his job, his independent business, because no one's building anything. He was primarily a plumber in new houses, so he had to find another job. Well, I have a lot of clients in the healthcare industry, and it's like, you know, nothing's changed with here. I mean, they're constantly looking and rocking and rolling, looking for help and making sure they engage their people. I mean, shortage of nurses is a huge thing. In fact, that's my ninth book. Me and a partner, a registered nurse here at Emory Hospital, writing a book just on retention of nurses.
Huh.
And that's a critical thing that's not going to change because of the economy. And Lord knows we want to have qualified healthcare people taking care of us when we're old, right? So there is no one answer. And I think a lot of times a lot of businesses are in trouble today because they haven't prepared for what has happened today.
Right.
They've allowed bureaucracy to build up. They've allowed inefficiencies to sneak into their organization like cancer that doesn't make them flexible and adaptive to this tough time we're in.
Now, in this tough time, is it a tendency for business to get that bunker mentality where we're going to just start cutting everything and we're going to hide here and we're going to wait this thing out? Like, how do you deal with that?
The usual reaction is the reaction, just like as you said, Lee, is that that we bunker down. And the first thing that gets cut is training, travel, and expense accounts.
Yeah.
And and to me, I look back to a gentleman named Hort Schultze. Maybe you recognize his name. He was the original founder and CEO of Ritz-Carlton. And during the last recession in the 70s is when everybody's cutting out, laying off people. And, you know, the hotel industry is always affected by
tough
times. He said, by golly, I'm going to make a difference. And I'm going to take my hotel organization, and it was very small back then, and make it the best hotel chain. And the people that will not get cut are the training and my quality people.
Wow.
And so he saw the crisis as an opportunity. And he transformed his chain into what we know today as an exceptional.
So at that time, they were just a regular hotel, and he totally repositioned them during a down economy?
Right, according to him. And part of my background is I was an examiner for the Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Award, which is, you know, most of us know, the nation's highest award for business excellence awarded by the President of the United States each year to just a handful of organizations that are selected. And the Ritz-Carlton is the only organization that has actually won that award twice.
Right, more than one time.
And, you know, Mr. Schultz is now retired, but he did it because he didn't want them to become part of the status quo.
Right, like a commodity, another hotel.
Yeah, to get lazy. And when you're successful, sometimes that's the worst thing for you because you get lazy and then all these problems we're experiencing today, the bureaucracy and inefficiency creep in. And to me, that's a transformational leader.
I noticed that in the name of your company, you have the word international. And I see that in a lot of companies. They'll have international in there. But I get the sense that you really are international and that you've worked with clients all over the globe. Is that the case?
I've worked in, traveled, or visited over 24 different countries and island nations.
Well, I thought that might be the case. What do you see, if anything, differently in different cultures in the way that they handle this whole issue of leadership?
It's different all over the world. And again, I think that my premise, my thesis is that every business, no matter what part of the country, you're going to have strong, effective leaders, whether you call them transformational or inspirational or whatever is needed, because everybody's affected by the global economy. What woke me up is when I went to China, and I've been to several Asian nations, but China, as a business consultant and an American citizen, I said, holy smokes, everybody in the United States needs to go to China and see what we're up against. I mean, talking about the work ethic and the, and I mean, you can feel the energy and,
really?
And the competition. And you see there's a whole lot of competition in the companies in China for becoming leaders. And you talk about turnover and retention, it's a huge problem there, because, you know, as we develop companies in China, we increase the pay scale, and so everybody's jumping ship for a little bit more money. And leadership experience is a major issue in the country of China. I was in Hong Kong speaking at a conference a few years ago, and the interesting in Hong Kong is they have something called the happiness barometer. And
what's that?
Once a year, they measure the happiness of their workforce. And they equate, if a worker is happy, they're going to be productive. Well, that may be,
there's an idea.
May be true.
Yeah.
And, you know, they work an insane amount of hours over in Hong Kong.
What's their work week? How many hours, do you know?
Well, it's hard to say, but I would say it's probably over 80.
Wow.
And less than 30% of those companies even have maternity benefits. And so what they're finding is a lot of American companies is we have a new generation workforce coming in, younger people coming in. They're not going to sacrifice their life.
They're not working 80 hours.
Mm-mm.
They're not working 80
hours. I'm sure they're
hours.
Working 40.
And that's part of the issue.
It's lifestyle, you know, versus
the older right. people retiring, moving out. Younger people have a totally different expectation. So therefore, the happiness is going down. And so they were bringing in Western thinking and talking about, you know, how do we adapt to make us competitive with all these changes in the workforce.
So what advice would you have for an organization that, at least intellectually, they understood the value of being better at leading? What tactically would you have them do other than engage you? Or is that the answer? Engage Greg.
No. That's step one.
Right.
Well, the best consultant is the one that doesn't work for you very long. And,
right.
and that's, you never want to be stuck with a consultant forever. But sometimes, you know, a consultant like myself is sort of like, you know, I love to sail. I like to take cruises. You have a pilot. A pilot comes aboard the big ship. You know, that's sort of why I came up with my company name, Chart Your Course International. And assist that big ship out of the port, out of the mm-hmm. harbor, until the captain can take over.
Right.
And that's sort of the way I look at myself. I help those organizations get started. But I think the first thing, when you look at transformational leadership, a characteristic of one would be someone who can champion a cause. Joel Barker, referenced earlier, has a great definition of leadership. And he says, a leader is someone who will take you to a destination you would not go to by yourself.
Hmm.
You know, a manager, you know, they help you get packed, but a leader takes you to that destination that you would not go to by yourself. And so a transformational leader, through this chaos and through this crisis, has got to rally the troops. He's got to champion a cause. He's got to get people to quit blaming each other and, you know, bickering and whining and say, you know, here we need to go, and focus that energy in a positive direction. And that requires, you know, personal leadership. One president of a hospital that I'm aware of called, you know, Baptist Hospital, and also Malcolm Baldrige winner. You know, when you go to a hospital, what do you think of executive leadership? You know, you've been down that hallway of the executive
right.
suite, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, you get that image in your picture, you know, sort
right.
of stoic and austere. But this the president of this hospital said, you know, how do we engage our people and create a good place to work? As he moved himself out of the executive suite to the cafeteria and put an office with glass walls
wow.
around. And he realized
well, that makes a statement.
And that's transformational. I can't remember the president's name, but, you know, he did such a great job. He won the award, and, of course, he got a new job somewhere else.
Right. Yeah, he's gone.
Made more money. But and that's the other part. You need to stabilize your leadership. You can't have them turning over all the time. And so you got to come up with a plan. You rally the troops. You have a cause greater than the problems that you see. And then you got to look at your organization. You know, to me, one of the inefficiencies we see in many organizations is, you know, is silos. And you talk to people in organizations, why they can't change, what they tell you is, well, I can't talk to such and such department. There's actual conflict
right.
and inefficiencies that block people from doing what they know is right.
Right.
And so to me, what you need to do is also put it in like a transformation team or a steering group and start looking at the issues that is keeping your company from moving forward, for being productive and efficient. And and then nail the issues on the wall for everybody to see, because everybody understands what's going on in an organization sometimes, except for leadership. So
right.
And I believe and when you look at Peter Drucker, the late Peter Drucker, the management consultant, and you look at the ideas and creativity that your own workforce has. And successful organizations capture that creativity and innovation and bring those ideas to the top. And, you know, whether those ideas are about cutting costs or improving customer service or whatever, you need to have a process to identify those issues. I worked with Yamaha many, many years ago. Yamaha, obviously, traditional Japanese company, you know, Japanese management and, you know, American workers. And they practice Kaizen. And you probably know what Kaizen is. It's Japanese for continuous improvement. And to me, it's a brilliant way of getting the people who are on the front line, who already know what the problems are, to identify the problems, fix the problems, and improve productivity. And that goes back to what I was saying earlier about Peter Drucker. He says the person on the front line knows better what the problems are than anybody else. The problem is management never listens to them half
right.
the time. And through these engagement practices, whether it's Kaizen or you know, we have something called the Bright Star Idea Campaign, which is like a suggestion program on steroids to capture hundreds of ideas from your workforce through our a process that we have designed to make your company relevant again. And you don't need to hire a bunch of consultants to tell you what you already know. The ideas are with your employees. You know, again, you may need someone to help you temporarily to get you started, but ask your people. They'll tell you.
How do you help a dysfunctional company, maybe that's gone through multiple layoffs? You know, it seems a new consultant comes in, gives them a direction, and then off they go for a year or two, and then boom, something else happens, and the employees are just gun shy of everything that comes out of the mouths of their managers. Like, how do you rebuild the trust in those kind of organizations?
Well, you know, sometimes we call that mental constipation, and that there's, when you constantly are changing, and you're constantly being bought out, and you're like Delta's going through a. Not get the name of
Northwest.
And going with Northwest.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And there's sometimes your people just get worn out and they don't trust management anymore. And I think it goes back to is the first thing you need to do, and we violate that many times, is build trust with the people that you're leading. And to me, until you have the trust established with your workforce and your leadership, you're limiting your potential.
Right. Is there anything you can do to build the trust? Like I always tell my kid, at least, you know, if you want people to trust you, is you have to be trustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the first step. You know, stop digging when you're in the hole. You have to prove yourself that you are going to keep your word and you are going to, you know, do what you say you're going to do.
Yeah, there's a need for that. There's one CEO of this one major corporation. What he used to do with the HR manager, he'd find out of an employee who went above and beyond the call of duty. And he called him up at home or on weekends and tells employees, I heard you did such and such, it makes me proud to be your CEO. And, you know, if the employee didn't die of a heart attack from shock, right, you know, they come back to work and tell all exactly. their coworkers. You know, that's part of building trust. And
it's like you said, when the CEO moves his office into the cafeteria, you
that
know,
is
that's
really cool.
You know, that's a statement that says, look, you can talk to me. I'm not, you know, above you. I'm not in, you know, some ivory tower somewhere.
Yeah, and we call that transparency. And you take a big risk when you're transparent because there's always somebody that's going to,
right,
you know.
Exactly.
The more transparent you are, the more you open yourself to personal attack. You know, just look at the political races. And but I think today that's what is really missing is that if you're going to establish trust and if you're going to get people, hopefully, and you're never going to get 100% of people rowing in the same direction. There's always going to be some people thinking we need to go back instead of go forward. But I think that's what people need, and I think particularly the younger workforce, that's what they expect. And, you know, making yourself accessible. You know, the same president of this hospital, he eliminated all perks for executives. First come, first serve parking spaces. No reserved places for executives.
He really did make some bold statements.
Well, I mean, it wasn't just this altruistic stuff. You know, they reduced turnover like by 15%. You know, nurse or healthcare turnovers right now, last we looked at, was like less than 10%. And when you're talking about the average industry, it's 30%. They're saving a whole lot of money.
Right.
Yeah.
You look at another company like SAS, Raleigh-Durham. It's one of the largest software companies. And they pay people less than the industry average. I mean, these are software developers. You know, they're in high demand everywhere right. you go. And it's a privately held company. That makes it a little bit easier to run your organization. One of the things they do is provide something like 22 tons of M&Ms to their employees every year.
That's the key.
They're paying
M&Ms.
Them in M&Ms.
Chocolate.
Well, don't go. You know, the listeners, don't go back and start providing M&Ms.
M&Ms. That simple.
Ain't gonna
go to Costco.
That isn't the only thing you're gonna have to do.
What kind of reception do you get initially when you try to have this conversation with a hard-nosed? Or at least what I perceive as, you know, the guy in the corner office, this hard-nosed executive that is focused on the bottom line. What kind of reception do you get when you try to have this conversation?
Well, as a consultant, you have to address both the left brain and the right brain. You know, you have to be able to substantiate what you're saying through statistics and figures. And, for example, I have statistics and figures. If you have a pool of money and you invest it into capital investment or hardware investment versus education development in your workforce, you're going to get a bigger result from developing in your people than if you're buying hardware. And many people think as well, you know, if I train my staff, they're going to quit and go somewhere else. Well, right. What do you have if you don't train them? A bunch of idiots.
Right. Exactly.
So, what, I mean, to me, that's nonsense.
High on candy, right?
So, you know, I've dealt with a lot of those bottom line oriented CEOs. I've worked with Army generals, and you know, sometimes you have to, you know, you just have to understand their needs, and you have to be able to show that these things really work. Because you need to think about interesting another IT company. You know, I can't mention their name, but they actually are so concerned about managing talent because, you know, these are certified engineers. They pay them, you know, 100,000+ a year, and they're hard to find. And they specifically asked them, what kind of reward do you want? You know, what makes you feel right. appreciated? Was it money? No. What it was they wanted a five-minute conversation with the CEO on the phone.
That was it.
That was what they wanted. Yeah, I mean, yeah, obviously you can't pay these people peanuts and they're
right.
not going
to
stay.
You have to be competitive.
You got to at least be competitive.
But not top dollar.
Yeah, you can't compete on money alone.
But what a novel idea. Ask them what they want in terms of reinforcement and compensation.
And do you get good information when you ask? Like a lot of times people don't know what they want. You know, it's hard for them to verbalize. Yeah. How do you get that out of them? You know, the real truth, not what they think they should say.
The critical thing is that relationship with the frontline manager. That's the shepherd. With those people. And we have something called an individual retention profile, which is a series of questions that we provide those managers that they need to ask their employees. and we make it mandatory. you know, you need to sit down with them, you know, 3-4 times a year and not talk about deadlines and work, but ask them these questions like, what's the highest form of recognition you ever got? If you won the lotto tomorrow, what would be the thing you missed about your job? And interesting, I have a son-in-law who's one of these engineers for these IT companies, and he was a graduate student from University of Georgia, and he went to several job interviews, and he had 3 or 4 offers before he made his decision. And with these talented people, you have to understand that. You're not really interviewing them.
They're interviewing you.
Right. There you go. Bingo. And interesting, you know, I always ask when he comes home, I says, well, how's the job going? And he recently said, well, it's going great until I got a new manager. So if you don't have good managers who are in tune with that person, then you stand to losing that person. Not just losing them physically, but what's really scary is that they're still working for you, but right. You've lost them. They've right. quit.
Worse.
They've quit, but they haven't told you yet. And because many times people quit 6 months before they actually walk out the door, and that's what we call engagement. And it's those things. I mean, it's not rocket science, but most companies don't do it very well.
Why do you think they don't do it very well?
They assume too much, and I think we've gotten so busy and we're so concerned about the bottom line that we forget that it's the people in our company who generate the bottom line. They're not expendable resources. And to me, if I'm running a company, I want to create a work environment where people come to work and can be productive. And yet, whether they're happy or they enjoy it is nice, but it's not critical. And yeah, I have to make a profit. But I realize if I don't take care of my people, my profit's going to be influenced about the productivity and the attitude of the people working for me. And the other problem, I think, why it doesn't happen, which is a good question, is we've created all these organizational silos, and we've taken the responsibility away from the managers. We've created the director of talent management. We've created the director of reengineering. And so what happens, you have this bureaucracy that seeps in that sometimes it's sort of like peanut butter that doesn't do what it's supposed to do.
So if I don't have a key to the executive washroom, I'm not on the penthouse floor, I'm mid-level management, but I really resonate with your message. And I intellectually buy into what you're talking about. What can I do if I'm not the CEO or that very senior level tier to, you know, aside from a bowl full of M&Ms, what are some other strategies that I might employ?
Well, buy my book, of course.
Well, yeah,
the secret of all that. All those questions you just asked me. Interesting thing is I spent 20 years in the military. And what I learned in that time is I made a lot of mistakes as a manager, as a leader. I went in the military to learn about leadership. And I think maybe that's sort of what fires me, what makes me passionate. Because I have seen people who, quote, unquote, didn't have it. You know, they aren't the top talented people, but with the right leadership, they can transform themselves into, you know, to do amazing things. I mean, we see these stories all the time, and those same leadership characteristics can be applied to the workplace. But a lot of times, as we have managers who don't feel capable of doing it, there's a confidence problem, and I think that's why there's a big need for management leadership training, is to give people confidence to do what you just asked me to do, Stone.
Yeah.
Is you got to learn, you know, and I learned through making mistakes. And the more mistakes you make, as we went back to the initial question earlier, is if you create an environment where people are so afraid to make a mistake, they don't do anything because of
fear.
They're
immobilized, yeah.
It's like turtles. Their head goes into the shell. and that's what's happening many times. But there's so many things to do. Is just, you know, be authentic. Know what the strengths of those workers are. You know, what are their strengths? And how do you ignite those strengths? And listen to their ideas. And be willing to admit that you make mistakes. And, you know, we'll probably talk about some of my mistakes here shortly. And I think if you're that way, it goes a long way to making yourself a more effective leader. You can't rule by fear. And I believe that majority of people want to do the best thing. And that's what leadership's job is all about.
If our listeners want to get some more insight and contact you about your books or want to maybe to have a conversation with you personally, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
Well, go to my website, which is Chart Course. That's chartcourse.com. Or they can call me at this phone number, 770-860-9464. That's 770-860-9464. And, you know, our website provides hundreds of articles for free and all sorts of resources as well.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show, but you know we're not going to let you go without our Return to Learning segment. It's our custom here, Greg, at the High Velocity Radio Show to ask each guest, if they would, to share a mistake that they've made somewhere in their career, and really more importantly, what they've learned from it. Would you be willing to do that for us?
Sure. There's so many different choices to talk about and mistakes I've made in the past. I remember I was running an organization, and once a year we had our annual company picnic, you know, like everybody does. And so I look to people in our organization who, I guess you would say, up-and-coming people who have potential, and I thought this would be a great opportunity to delegate this responsibility to. And there was a young man who worked in our organization, had a lot of potential, and he was liked by his coworkers. And I brought him in one day, and I said, I would like you to take on the responsibility for planning this company picnic. Well, the first mistake I made is fail to realize my own company culture, that in the past has been run by, you know, these, I mean, this was a dental organization. We had a lot of hygienists, and people have been there for years and years. They pretty much liked their traditional company picnic. And so I picked this guy, and he's sort of a renegade, and I said, well, what do you think you want to do? And he said, well, I saw them cook a pig once or roast a pig. I think it would be fun if we roasted a pig. And I'm so thinking to myself, you know, this is never going to work. But I know the culture of my organization is going to sort of guide him back to the traditional way of doing things. Mistake number two. So the first thing he did was fire the former company picnic committee team and brought in all his friends. And they're all fired up about roasting this pig. They never roasted a pig before. They watched it on TV. And so I'm thinking, all of a sudden, I mean, my boss got wind of this, and he comes in my office and says, Greg, what the heck have you done? He said, this guy's going to kill all of us. He doesn't know how to roast a pig. We're all going to get, you know, poisoned. And I had to bring this guy in and relieve him of that responsibility. And I knew I had ruined him because I destroyed his prestige, and because I failed to manage that situation properly. I assumed that the traditional people would control him, and they didn't. And that was a major mistake because, you know, it was my fault, and I'll never forget that.
Well, I think it's great that you accept some personal accountability for your role in that. I think, from my perspective, that is so important in a leader to both take and expect personal responsibility for corporate results. What a marvelous...
What an innovative idea.
What a marvelous lesson to share with our listeners. Well, thank you again so much for joining us. I hope you'll come back sometime.
I appreciate it. I hope to do come back. And remember, you know, choose your destiny. You remember the movie Gladiator, and Maximus is on his horse ready to – he's trying to motivate his soldiers to charge the enemy. And he says, what you do in life will echo in eternity. You know, it's a lot more fun when you try to do something different.
Oh, so well said. Well, until next week, this is Stone Payton, Lee Cantor, and Greg Smith – and everyone here at the Radio X family saying, have a good week, and we'll see you in the fast lane.